hey, you know, if you are just doing the right things, like Silicon Valley is just like anywhere else, you know, just being a good person and doing the right things makes you, you know, better than, you know, 50% of people out here, just like everywhere else.
Hello and welcome back to the Arena Podcast by Kauffman Fellows, where we dive deep into the stories of some of the most fabled names in VC. I'm your producer, Nihar Nilakanti, and this podcast is hosted by Jeff Harbach, CEO of Kauffman Fellows. Joining us in today's episode is Jeremy Yap, a prolific full-time angel investor in over 77 different investments globally and is a Kauffman Fellow from Class 19. We can't wait to share his story with you, so let's get right to it.
All right, welcome back to the Kauffman Fellows podcast. Today we are in the arena with Jeremy Yap. Quickly on Jeremy, Jeremy is a full-time angel investor. He has a portfolio of 77 different investments across 18 different cities, spends most of his time between Europe, the US, and Singapore. Previously, he worked at Merrill Lynch in London and was also a commissioned lieutenant in the Singapore Armed Forces. Jeremy is a Kauffman Fellow from Class 19, and this is Jeremy's very first, not only very first podcast, but very first public media engagement ever. So that we are incredibly honored. Thanks, Jeremy.
Thanks. This is what the sort of things that Kauffman makes me do.
I love it. We're putting it to you. So Jeremy, what does a full-time angel investor do? I've heard you call yourself a nomadic angel. What? Tell me what you do and what kind of a typical day in Jeremy's life looks like.
Yeah, I mean, I have never worked for a venture fund, but I can only imagine that a full-time angel is very similar to working in a VC, except there's only one person. So a single GP, single LP.
Yep.
My day is almost entirely consisting of, you know, obviously just going through emails and meetings. The problematic or the interesting thing that's a bit different from what I do is, as you mentioned, I invest in 18 different cities. I make a commitment to visit all those cities at least once a year, which means I fly a lot. So there's a lot of travel, and you know, that's sort of what I enjoy, and it's also sort of, to some degree, is also my sort of, you know, like unique selling proposition to some degree. You know, what I tell founders is essentially I act like a VC in the sense that I create a portfolio. I invest in 10 to 12 companies a year. I do reserve for follow-ons, very much like a VC, and I think about my portfolio construction a lot. But at the same time, I'm an angel. It's my name on the cap table. You only ever have to deal with me. And because of that, I can do a lot of things that a VC can't do or will have less flexibility to do. And I feel like I try to use that to my advantage.
How do you balance your time between, you know, sourcing or meeting new companies, meeting new founders, engaging in you know, really interesting technologies versus also spending time with the current portfolio that you've invested in? How do you manage that as a single GP LP?
Yeah. So first, no board seats. that's very helpful. Well, that's a lie. There's one board seat, but you know, like after the one, I realized how much time and what a commitment it was that I've decided not to do anymore. Second is, you know, even though I invest in a lot of companies, I tend to always be a minority investor as an angel. You know, it's very rare that I would own more than 5% of the company, and it's much more common that the number would be closer to 1%. And so usually for the majority of my companies, there's not a lot of expectation for me to spend a lot of time with them. I'm not sitting on the board, you know, I'm not a majority shareholder. But at the same time, you know, I do try to optimize for building relationships and being helpful to the founders. So, you know, I will not invest in a company that I don't feel like I can build a relationship with. You know, I try to keep things very casual. You know, obviously face-to-face is much harder. So, and also I don't feel like I usually want to take up too much of a founder's time unless it's something specific that they need from me. So I keep things very casual. You know, I'm on WhatsApp with almost all of them or some sort of messenger. We ping each other all the time. Everything is very low load, light touch. And, you know, and then it usually starts with like, you know, very quick questions or, hey, do you have a minute to talk? And then just get on a quick call for 5-10 minutes or, unless I need to sit down on something larger like fundraising strategy or going through product or something along those lines. So yeah, so I would say that, you know, 77 companies is actually the actual number of companies I've committed to invest in or invested in. And that's over 7 years. And so, you know, some of those companies aren't around anymore. A bunch of them have exited. So it tends to average itself out, I think, to around 40 to 50 at any one time.
One of a very well-respected Coffin Fellow has said in the past that if I could just invest in a portfolio of Jeremy Yap's angel investments, I would be doing really well. So, you know, congratulations to the things that you're doing and the founders that you're investing in. We're, you know, I'm sure they're grateful for your input as well. What's the latest city that you've invested in?
Latest city I've invested in is actually Atlanta.
Atlanta, Georgia.
Atlanta, Georgia. I'm very proud of that one.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, I've only been there once and I have not met the founder in person yet, but I'm very excited to. And yeah, it's a company that has a very good reason to be in Atlanta, and they're covering Atlanta and the American South, which I think is super interesting.
So from all the different cities you invested in all across the world, all the different continents, the latest city, and maybe, you know, I dare say one of the most exciting opportunities you've seen recently because you invested in it is in Atlanta, Georgia. That's really awesome.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think because I have the reputation of, you know, being happy to invest anywhere, primarily, like majority of my investments are still in Europe, but, you know, I'm happy to look at anything sort of like what I call the Western Internet. So sort of like the US and Europe and any companies that are building products for that sort of area.
So let's rewind the tape a little bit and let's go back to early childhood. Tell us about you know, your beginnings. Tell us about where you were born. Tell us about your family.
Yeah, so I was actually born in Houston, Texas. But I'm not American. So my parents are both Singaporean. They were both oncologists, actually, cancer specialists. So they were both at MD Anderson. So me and my brother were both born there. And when I was seven, my brother was seven and I was four, we moved back to Singapore. My parents just felt that they wanted to go back and they wanted us to grow up in their home country. Yeah, growing up in Singapore is great. It's the education system is great. Obviously, everyone knows about that. But I guess, you know, I think something that's, yeah, this is going to get dark very, very fast, but something that was really particular about my own childhood is that, ironically, even though my parents were both oncologists, in fact, they were the first clinical oncologists in Singapore, my father actually got cancer himself, which he contracted or which he discovered when I was 12 years old. And it was actually a terminal diagnosis, so he sort of had, you know, the doctors were saying he had 6 months to live. You know, obviously my parents were very well regarded and they knew sort of everyone. And so I remember as a young child, like sort of traveling with my parents, going to see all of their all of the best specialists, especially in the US. And my mother actually decided at the end, that, you know what, I feel like I know Asian patients better than any of these guys. And I'm not happy with this diagnosis. So she actually decided to treat my father, which I guess is something that doesn't really happen in America. You're not really supposed to do, but she did. And so my father, you know, ended up living for another 6 more years, which is incredible. But that also comes with, you know, a very, very difficult situation, because, you know, you're sort of in a situation where you kind of always expect you're kind of basically just waiting for your dad to die, right? Like any minute now, this is going to happen, right? And it's just an extension of life, and especially back then. And so that was very difficult. You know?
Especially in a formative time in your life, between the ages of 12 and 18.
Yeah. You know, I mean, since we're going into it, I would actually say that it's the most impactful thing in my life. So something that's interesting, like today, you know, if you ask people about me or you talk to me, you know, I seem like a super friendly, outgoing guy, definitely extroverted. You know, I'm always out and about. I'm always like meeting people. You know, building relationships is what I love doing. But at the same time, if you met me when I was 11 or 12, I was very quiet, very shy, would not approach people, extremely confrontation adverse. And I think what happened back then is that, you know, I was in a situation where, sadly, I just never wanted to be at home. Like home when I was growing up was, like as a teenager for me, was always very dark. It was always very depressing. As a survival strategy, I just basically had to constantly go out and make friends and figure out how to do it. How do I make friends? How do I talk to people? This compounded this became even worse when I went to college. So, to my father's delight, and this is what he always wanted for me, was to, you know, I went to school in the U.S. I went to Penn undergrad, Wharton. But I also went because of the particular dynamics around national service and national military service in Singapore, and the way that the school education system worked. I actually had to apply to college early, such that I could defer my military service till after. And because of that, I went to college when I was 16. Essentially, I mean 16, and you know, like I was like 3 months shy of 17, which causes its own problems. And it's also kind of difficult. And so you can only imagine a 16-year-old boy heading off to college, thinking that his father's going to die any minute now, and you know the amount of guilt and the amount of like you know unpreparedness I had at the time for that was something that you know I still remember today.
You had to do a lot of growing up really fast. I mean,
pretty much, yeah. You know, so college things flipped as well. You know, I was in college, and you know the sort of the dual life. I had this sort of dual life where every time I'd be by myself and at home, I'd be super depressed. I would cry myself to sleep, and I just never want to be at home again. So another situation where I just don't want to be alone in my dorm room. So I have to go out and make friends. So basically made friends with everyone. I would just hang out in other people's dorm rooms, just learning how to, and very awkwardly so, you know, like even now, like I always tell people, yeah, and people have known me for a long time. Every 5 years, I feel like there's like a almost, if you would just meet me at 5 year points, it's almost like a slight evolution, a continuous evolution, where you know I was very awkward in college. You know, I was a kid that you know we would all go watch TV at someone's place, and then I go to the bathroom, and then everyone will be so funny if when he comes back, no one is here, and then they'd all leave, and then I come back to the room, and I'm like, oh, where is everybody? And then they're like laughing at me. I was that guy. So. You know, and then, you know, eventually just learn how to socialize a little bit better and a little bit better and a little bit better. And, you know, just like I think many of us, you know, if you are optimizing something, sadly, if you're optimizing something from a place of pain, you become very motivated to do it. And you learn very, very quickly because you kind of have to. Yeah.
Where was your brother during this? Your brother's 3 years older than you, right?
Yeah. So my brother also went to college early. He went to Yale. He's a little smarter than me. Yeah, and my brother's very different. You know, he was a lot older when it all happened. He was kind of already on his way to the U.S. My brother is actually an American. He very American. He worked at the Department of Justice. So in Singapore, we're not allowed to have dual citizenship. So at 21, we had to choose, essentially, which is actually part of the reason I skipped a step, which is part of the reason why we wanted to go to college early so we could make that choice before we did military service, essentially.
Would you say you're more like your mother?
You know, I think we're both a combination of both, I would say, yeah. My mother, we can talk about that in a second as well, but like, my mother is also, like, I would say, as an individual, is probably the biggest influence in my life.
How so?
Yeah, so, you know, my mother's incredible, you know, so my, you know, she is, you know, I'm obviously biased, but, you know, she's the most successful physician in Singapore. She's the most well-regarded oncologist in the region as a woman. And you can only imagine, you know, a woman going back to Singapore and having to treat Asian patients as a doctor. I don't think that's something that, you know, I mean, even she would tell me, like women with breast cancer, which she specialized in the beginning, would prefer to see a male doctor rather than her, which just blows my mind, right? You know, but then, you know, when my father got sick, she treated my father through all those years. Something I failed to mention was, you know, in 1997 was the Asian financial crisis. You know, the stock markets collapsed. You know, our family was actually like in about a debt, and my mother had to sort of just like claw everything together. They used to practice together at the same time, and I think, you know, from the day that my father got sick to, you know, like just like the couple of years before he passed away, I think my mother ended up seeing more patients on a daily basis than both of them combined.
Wow.
Yeah, and she just, I mean, she, you know, talking about growing up in that period, you know, like as much as I did, I think my mother sort of just emerged from that as just this, you know, like, I don't know what to say, just, you know, this superhero. And one of the things that really, I would say, is was a big influence for me is just how, you know, obviously capable and intelligent and accomplished as she is, but she's also the most generous person I know. So she put many of my cousins through college. She supports my grandmother. She supports my grand aunt. She just always opens her door to everybody. You know, as a doctor, actually, the easiest example would be she gives all of her patients her cell phone number or her pager number or home number. I remember when as a kid, you know, people would call her at like maybe call it midnight, call the house, and I had no understanding back then. I'd pick up the phone, it's like, my mom's sleeping, go away, and I'd hang up. You know, but that's the sort of person she is. You know, she just incredible. And even as a teenager, I would always think to myself, like, you know, so many people are taking advantage of you. You know, you sort of give so much, you open so much of yourself to being for people to exploit you, but you never care about that. And you know, it's incredible. And you know, as I got older, I started to realize, you know, it that stuff doesn't matter, right? People will exploit you, people will take advantage of you, people will betray you. But like, you know, all that negative stuff happens maybe once, and it's such a small part. But the positive, you know, the family she's created around her, and when I say family, you know, it really is just like the people who, you know, who will always have her back, who always have my back, my kids' back. You know, they're just people. Yeah, it's just incredible. You know, a very quick example is, you know, my grandmother had a very bad scare where we thought we lost her, and in the process she started to bleed again, and basically game over. Like somehow she pulled through in the end, but at that moment in time it was basically game over, and it was like we were there in the hospital, and the doctor who you know my mother had helped so much, who was taking care of her, you know, he burst into tears, and he basically just like. I always remember this. He just burst into tears and just like, you know, like, I failed you. You've done so much for me. I can't believe this. Like, I can't believe it. He just couldn't stop like crying. And I just thought to myself, you know, this guy, you know, like he will really be there for all of us forever. You know, and he's so grateful. And my mom is such a big part of his life. And, you know, it's just having one person like that is, you know, way worth, like so much better than like worth having, you know, all the other people, and there's so many stories of people who would take advantage of mother and so on and so forth. And I think that's sort of like when I realized,
she's an incredible person. Incredible person. So now here you are, 16-year-old going halfway across the world to Penn. You graduate, and you now have to make this decision. Do I or don't I join the Singaporean Armed Forces and be a Singaporean citizen or a U.S. citizen? Walk us through that decision process.
Yeah, I think for me, it was always going to be, you know, I was almost always pretty sure I was going to be a Singaporean. I was always going to move back to be with my family. And I think, you know, I just went through the same motions as my brother. Because my brother was actually the one who sort of, like I said, he's way smarter. He was the one who figured this loophole out. He's the one who applied to Yale. You know, I was sort of the kid who had to be forced to do all this stuff. My dad had to like push me. No, you turn me. You have to do all these things just like your brother. And I was like, okay, fine, because he did it. I got to try and doing it myself. So I kind of always knew I was going to come back. You know, even if I don't eventually move back to Singapore, I think just how much I feel like Singapore is home, and just having the sort of option to keep it as my home, I feel like the 2.5 years is totally worth it. Yeah.
And tell us about that experience. What was the armed forces like?
Well, it's funny because you think about it now. Like, I mean, I think this is common for everyone who goes through a national service in Singapore. You go through it now, and you think to yourself, like, oh wow, I learned so much, and you know, like, you know, all the things it hardened me as a human being, and so on. And it was such a great experience. But then I also remember when I was there, and you know, in the few weekends that we could come out, I would basically just meet up with friends and just be super depressed and like drink ourselves into stupor, like, oh my god, what are we doing? This is so bad. It's terrible. So yeah, so you know, I think there's a lot of like sort of revisionist history when you sort of think about it.
Revisionist history plays a role in all of our lives, Jeremy, not just yours, I promise. Okay, so now you go from, you know, walk us through the next part of your life. You go from armed forces to becoming a trader at Merrill Lynch. Mm-hmm. That, and you started as a associate?
Yeah, so I started as a...
Analyst?
Analyst, yeah. So, you know, first job out of college, went to Merrill Lynch in London. Actually, you know, I was trying to go anywhere in Europe, essentially. The idea was that I kind of wanted to explore a new culture And you know, and I sort of had it in my head to go to Frankfurt, learn German, and work for a bank in Germany. If I knew I was going to go into finance, essentially I was pushed into this role. You know, unlike my brother, who always kind of like knew what he wanted to do, I didn't. And so, you know, I just sort of settled into the role that my father wanted me to play, right? So essentially, okay, you have to go to Wharton. You know, I actually really wanted to go to Swarthmore or Pomona, but he's like, no, you go to Wharton, you're going to be a finance guy, you're going to do this. And I was like, okay, you know, like I didn't feel like I didn't want to do it. So I just said, okay, might as well just do it. And then graduated from college and was like, okay, you know, I guess I go apply for that finance job and try and get something. I think having gone through the military, I sort of thought to myself, well, now I have this thing where I can sort of pretend that, you know, I'm like a hardened person where, you know, stress doesn't bother me. And so I can, maybe trading would be better than investment banking, which is what I did originally for my internships. I guess I went to Merrill Lynch in London, which is interesting. You know, so I was there all through the financial crisis, which was not easy. You know, and you know, something that was you know, I would have to say is in terms of an influence is I actually can't discount what an impact going into finance had on me. You know, I think before I started work, I wasn't a straight A student. I didn't win any awards. I was good, you know, obviously good enough to get a job, good enough to get to college, but you know, I just never felt that I was you know, amazing at anything. And I think one of the things that finance gave me, or a job in finance gave me, was it was the first time where, you know, I was very good at it. You know, I moved up the ranks very, very quickly. To a large degree, I was at the right place at the right time. You know, I cycled through 10 to 11 different bosses, and that's just a reflection of the climate at the time. You know, you're going through the financial crisis, going through so much movement and turmoil, and I moved up very, very quickly. Right, it's almost like the Game of Thrones chaos is a ladder. It really worked for me in some sense. And you know, very, very quickly, I managed a team of 5 people, and then very, very quickly, I managed a team of another 11 people, so I managed 16 people by the end of my tenure there in 2012. I think, you know, I if you met me the day before I went to Maryland the day after, I think it's really completely different, right? And you actually do see this. You know, you see a lot of kids. You see a lot of math kids come out of college and then they work in finance for 5 years and then suddenly they have this like finance confidence, or like sometimes it manifests itself in not a very healthy or sociable way, but you know, you definitely see it, right? And you definitely see people starting to, like, you know, feel great about themselves for the amount of money that they've made or the success they've had in their jobs and so on and so forth, which has its own problems. But
we talked about some of the things that you learned being a derivative trader. You know, what? Tell us some of the things that you learned, or maybe some of the value that it placed in your journey.
Whew, yeah. To be honest, you know, like, I, you know, like we could take a step to the next step of the story. In 2012, you know, I was at Merrill, and I just thought to myself, you know what, I'm now a manager. I'm now no longer trading. I'm just, you know, I the learning curve has flattened out like years ago. You know, I'm obviously doing very, very well. I'm getting very, like, you know, like some may say, and I actually would agree, like massively overpaid. But at the same time, like, it didn't feel very meaningful. I'm not gonna lie, like to be honest, like, you know, I would walk around Shoreditch in London where I was living at the time and go out and meet people, and I wouldn't want to tell people what I did for a living, because it's just, you just think to yourself, like, how could you do something where you're embarrassed to tell people what you're doing? This is really not great. You know, and as a manager, it's just mostly politics, right? So you're working on a trading floor, which is super cutthroat. You know, the bottom the lowest percentile of traders get cut every year. It's really every man for himself. You know, it really creates a Game of Thrones like political environment. And you know, while that's fun and entertaining for like maybe a year, you know, I'm not going to do that for 4 or 5 years. After 4 or 5 years, I mean, it's a little too much, and so I decided to leave. Had no idea what I was going to do. Leaving was extremely stressful. Obviously my mother was not very happy with me when I did that. Suddenly the golden child of the family has burned out, and he couldn't hack it, and he gave up this amazing career, and he can't do anything. And I can only imagine what the sort of like society or friends and family members that, you know, who want to be mean about it will say, right? It's incredible. And that would stress me out. You know, it's funny, like my mother's very sweet, but she would like call me in the day that I quit, or the day after I quit, she'll call me and she's like, "Oh, hi, Jeremy. How's it going?" It's like, "Great. Like, what do you do today?" "Oh, I went to a yoga class." It's like, "Oh, okay. What are you going to do tomorrow?" It's like, "I don't know, Mom." Then that's the end of the conversation. Next day, she's like, "Hi, Jeremy. How's it going? What are you going to do today?" "Oh, my God. Kill me now." And I really had no idea. You know, so the plan was I was going to take 6 months off. Meet as many people as possible, learn about as many things as possible, and at the end of 6 months, I would decide, and I would start doing that, and that would be my new career. So I met a lot of people, and you know, guess what? Probably the easiest subset of people to meet is entrepreneurs. And then, especially if they know that you have a lot of money, and they're like, "Oh, great, let's meet this guy." So I go to all these different events, I meet a whole bunch of people, and I actually then ended up, you know, meeting an entrepreneur that I really liked, but wasn't doing something that I wanted to join. But it also occurred to me that I really didn't know very much about the entrepreneurial world. You know, I was sitting in my finance hole for so many years, and you know, this 2012, I didn't have a LinkedIn account. I barely knew what a hashtag was. You know, I was so sort of behind in what the sort of real world was doing, at least in the social world. And so I thought to myself, you know, maybe I should invest in this company and as a way to learn, right? So I said, I'll invest in this one company and then maybe, you know, and then I sort of had this sort of like naive idea that, you know, by investing in a company, I would be involved, like be really involved, and I could learn a lot about it or learn about what's going on. Then I invested in another company, and then I invested in another company. And I guess this is where sort of the finance part kicks in, and I start to look at the numbers, and I'm like, okay, you know, I've invested in three companies now. What is this? What have I done? And you know, so I start to look at the numbers and look at the market, and I'm like, oh my God, what have I done? Like, this is the worst asset class I've ever seen. Unbelievable. The amount of like, you know, information asymmetry, the like super illiquid. You know, like all the data I could get has massive survivorship bias. You know, and like the returns follow an exponential curve, which means that, you know, basically if you're doing angel investing, like at least 70, probably 80% of angels are just gonna lose money straight up, right? And I just thought to myself, you know, I have, here's me, right? Like no network, no deal flow, no domain expertise, bottom of the food chain was like the dentist as a finance guy, right? So I just thought, okay, you know, this is probably a hopeless scenario. But at the same time, you know, I just felt that maybe there's something here. Maybe there's an opportunity for me to learn, right? And so I thought to myself, okay, maybe I'll do this. I'll take 2 years off. I'll invest in 20 companies. And, you know, if I do it in a smart, disciplined, and diverse way, maybe I'll only lose as much money in the long run as an MBA would have costed me, right? And so that's what I decided to do. So I went out and started investing in companies. I went to all the conferences. I went to meet as many people as possible, traveled like crazy. And and then I think after 2 years, I realized this is actually the best thing I've ever done in my life. You know, I didn't realize it when I was a trader, but you know, I especially when I was going around meeting so many like amazing entrepreneurs and people, that I love getting to know people. You know, I might be a little shy sometimes to meet new people, but at the same time, I loved getting to know people. I loved getting to know super intelligent people with great visions. You know, like amazing missions, and you know, the learning curve was always steep. And so, yeah, so at year two, I decided, and then I looked around, I looked at my portfolio, obviously 2 years in like a, you know, in the start of the 10-year bull cycle, but, you know, I thought to myself, you know, doesn't seem like I'm doing too bad. And even reputationally, you know, I had great relationships with like quite a few of the founders I invested in. You know, I had a very good reputation among among the investing community in Europe and in London. And this was just from, you know, doing everything that the blog says, you know, like always be super fast, don't mislead people, like you know, just good behavior, just from pure, like, standard good investing behavior. I felt that I was able to, like, build a great reputation for myself, and it was maybe possible that I could get to that top 20% of brand, network, reputation. And if that's possible, then maybe I could make money doing this. And then I thought, if this is the best thing I've ever done, I kind of owe it to myself to try. So decided in 2014, I will go all in. Now it's like actually 7 years later, which is to this month, 7 years later, I guess I've created an occupation of it.
And you've gone from someone that is, you know, kind of in your early years, a kind of self-proclaimed someone that is afraid, or not afraid, but conscious of and tries to avoid confrontation and almost even has a fear of confrontation, to now being someone that really is focused on connecting people, building communities. Some of your most meaningful experiences have come through, I mean, I've been with you in, I don't know, countless different cities and countries around the world. And everywhere we go, you're constantly taking different people from different walks of life and putting them together, hoping that they're going to build something incredible, maybe even just a relationship, and if not, a company. Mm-hmm. How did you go from someone that had a fear of confrontation and that, you know, was that person to now this person that's so passionate about building communities?
Well, I mean, I did get over my fear of confrontation, you know, partially in the army and then on the trading floor. But, you know, you kind of hide it. You never lose it. It's always there, right? So, you know, you can gloss over it and you can pretend and you can act, which I had to do a lot of as a manager. I'd have to act that I was angry. But, or the platoon commander for that matter. At the same time, you know, I the best thing about being sort of an angel investor is that, and working for myself is, you know, I can hang out with the people I like hanging out with, to some degree. And I think also, you know, sort of, you know, my entire style of, you know, I mean, taking it all the way back to you know, wanting to make friends all the time, and always wanting to be around people. I think you sort of learn the skill of just being very pleasant and easy to be around. Right. And I think that's all I wanted to do when I was in college. I didn't have to be the cool kid, as long as I was a kid that they just let hang around, and maybe call up and say, tell me what you're doing so I can go hang out. And that was fine for me. And I think that's sort of a skill set that I've learned, that just, you know, I guess allows me to get along with people really well. And I think sort of, yeah, which has been great. Yeah.
So Jeremy, for someone that's been all around the world in so many different cities, you had had so many different memorable experiences. You had a particularly memorable experience in Tel Aviv. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, so I skipped a step when I was talking about when I first started, which was, you know, after a few, like 6 months in London, I decided that I'd go back home for 6 months to, or at the time, I wasn't sure for how long, in Singapore, and to sort of check out the tech scene there, which is actually where I met, you know, Vinnie Loria, who was the first person to put me onto the, you know, put the Kauffman Fellowship on the map for me. And while I felt that Singapore was very, very interesting, there's massive growth and massive opportunity in Southeast Asia, I just felt also at the same time, you know, there wasn't a lot of sort of new innovation in terms of like new products or new types of businesses. There's amazing execution and there's amazing, you know, huge companies being built. But if I wanted to sort of like, I think a more successful strategy, especially for a lot of these funds, would be either from people who had experience in Europe or the US and they would come to Singapore and use that experience to carve their own investing thesis out. I felt that, you know, I wasn't there yet. You know, I didn't have any experience from, you know, what was happening in the US or Europe. So if I was going to do my sort of 2-year MBA, Singapore wasn't really the right place for it. I mean, it will be eventually, I'm confident, but not at that time. And so I thought to myself, well, you know, if Singapore isn't the right place for it, why do I feel like London is? You know, London was completely arbitrary. It's just where I had my first job. So I started to look around the world and saying, okay, where you know, why doesn't Singapore have as great a local entrepreneurial environment? And so I wanted to answer that question as well. And I looked around, and obviously, you know, Israel kind of sort of popped up as, you know, sort of the entrepreneur nation, right? And there's so many similarities to Singapore. I just felt that it would be super interesting for me to go check it out. So I decided, you know, kind of off on a whim, to after going to a conference 1 year and really liking it, I kind of decided, yeah, let me go to Israel. I decided to spend a month there. Just didn't know many people, but you'll be surprised that, you know, if you just tell people you're going somewhere for a month, everyone introduces you to their friends. And in a place like Israel, everyone in Israel has another friend who did this, or another friend who's in tech. And I loved it simply because it was just one of the most welcoming environments I've ever been in. You know, like I said, you know, I went in there maybe knowing like 5 to 10 people, and those 5 to 10 people would just constantly introduce me to, you know, another like 30 people, and those 30 people could introduce me to another 20 to 30 people. And by the end of the month, you know, just like there's like too many people to meet, and everyone is so welcoming. People would be inviting me to their homes for Shabbat dinners. People would, you know, always be happy to take me out. And something that was also very interesting is that it was clear that people were so happy that, you know, I decided, hey, I want to come to Israel to learn, and I want to come to Israel to potentially invest. And I think everyone is just so astounded by the story. Like, what? This guy from Singapore is coming here to do what? Like, why is he here? Like, what's going on? And people would actually reach out to me. There's like, word would get around. It's not a very large ecosystem. And people would reach out to me to meet, because they're like, well, I want to know what's going on with this guy. It's kind of funny. And I think I just had such a great experience with Israel that you know, I just kept going back. You know, so I made investments there. I'm there regularly. I have a lot of my like closest friends now are Israeli, which is kind of funny. And it's just been a phenomenal experience.
From trader for 15 years to angel investor for 7 years, what role did Coffin Fellows, and what role has Coffin Fellows played in this journey of yours?
Yeah, Coffin Fellows, you know, it's interesting. I was doing my 2-year MBA of sorts, and that 2 years was sort of coming to a close. I guess that was 2016, and I was sort of wondering what's next. And you know, I in my sort of world traveling and looking at different cities to sort of explore, I mentioned Vinny before. Vinny was one of the first people I met in the Kauffman Fellowship. And, you know, every time I went to a new city, I would always try to figure out, okay, who could I meet here? Like, how do I get in with the local ecosystem? And I would basically go online, look on, you know, social networks, AngelList, blogs, news, and sort of look at people, find out, do I have any friends in common with these people? And Vinny just kept on popping up. Oh, Vinny knew this guy in Chicago, knew this guy, this woman in Spain. And he just seemed to know people everywhere. And so I was wondering, like, how do you know all these people, Vinny? He's like, oh, I was part of this Kauffman Fellowship program. Maybe you should look into it. And I think that's sort of how it started. And then a very close friend of mine in London, who we were investing together, sort of met Phil Wickham at a conference and was convinced to join it. And so this is Fede, also class 19, and he, you know, sort of convinced me, hey, we should do this thing together. And I just thought to myself, you know what, yeah, you know, if I've finished my 2-year MBA, now this could be like my postgraduate program. And that's how it started. And it's been a phenomenal experience. I mean, I think the emphasis on the person is incredible, you know, like the emphasis on the community within the class. I think I would actually consider many of my classmates to be, you know, my closest friends and the people that I would go to first if I ever need help or need anything, especially professionally, but even personally. You know, I think the exposure to Silicon Valley was great. You know, I think before Kauffman, I was actually, like, to be really honest, I was like, so I traveled from Tel Aviv to, you know, to New York, to Boston, all over Europe, Asia. But you know, Silicon Valley just always seemed like this insurmountable mountain, and I just didn't want to be, you know, the ex-finance guy thinks he can be an angel investor, goes to Silicon Valley, and it's like, and like, yeah, I just didn't want to deal with that. I was too scared to deal with that. But you know, I think Kauffman sort of like just helped me see that, you know, hey, you know, if you are just doing the right things, like Silicon Valley is just like anywhere else. You know, just being a good person and doing the right things makes you, you know, better than, you know, 50% of people out here, just like everywhere else, right? And And I think that was great. And it was sort of the exposure to I guess, all of the successful investors was also something that was very eye-opening to me, because it's also something where I realized that every great investor was completely different, like completely different methodology, completely way different ways of thinking about the world. And, you know, obviously there are some things that are consistent, but, you know, in their approach, but everyone had their own way of being successful. And it sort of inspired me to say, hey, I can also be successful too. And I can do it my own way, and just find the way that I want to do it that's genuine and authentic to me, and just, you know, go full speed ahead on that. And that's what I've done since.
Jeremy, you said in the past, you said that you never felt like I was amazing at anything, where you had this older brother that was, you know, really good at, you know, he got into Yale, you went to Penn, which, by the way, Penn is still an excellent school. If you went back to any particular point in your life, any, you know, different inflection points, I mean, I think about the 16-year-old Jeremy who knows that his father is not well, whose mother is treating him, who goes away to school as a 16-year-old dealing with a bunch of, you know, people that are 18, 19 as freshmen and much older than that as upperclassmen. What would you go back and tell either 16-year-old Jeremy, or I guess you can pick another point in your life, Jeremy, but what would you go back and tell them? Would you thank that young man? Would you give that young man some advice? I think I want to stick with 16-year-old, because boy, that was a really big point in your life. What would you tell 16-year-old Jeremy?
You know, it's an interesting thing, because I'm not sure I would tell him anything. I think it's a difficult thing to sort of to think about and to live with, which is, you know, a fundamental part of who I am and where I am today came from sort of the struggle, or came from the circumstance, right? Very, very painful circumstance. And I would never wish that on, you know, I mean, 16-year-old me, like, I mean, it's horrible. It's sort of like, it's terrible, but at the same time, you know, who I am today, I'm very happy with who I am today. And I, you know, it's hard to sort of live with that sort of dichotomy where, like, I don't want to have gone through that, but then I'm happy to have gone through that today because, you know, it's really adapted me. You know, like, I had this very funny conversation with my family, my mother, my brother, and where, you know, if we had grown up in America, if my parents had not moved back, what would have happened? How would we, like, would we be different? And, you know, I think we came to the conclusion that my brother would be exactly the same, but, you know, fundamentally, I think at my core, obviously I'll be the same person, but, you know, I think my personality would be very different, because ultimately for me, my personality was to sort of adjust to figure out how to fit in, how to make things work. I think I'm very good at that, and I'm very malleable, and that's a large part of my success, but also sort of makes me wonder, it makes me think about it. Yeah, it makes me think about it a lot, actually. Like, was it worth it? I don't know.
So introspective. Jeremy, last question for you. As you think about, you were very open. Gosh, in your first podcast interview, you've done really well. I hope that your mom listens to this. I hope she gets to hear you say how strong she was to have you call her a superhero and also the most generous person you know. Assuming that she does listen to this, what would you tell your mom? You know, maybe a reflection on the impact that she's had on you. Would you thank her? What's a message that you'd share with your mom, and maybe also with your dad?
Yeah, I mean, I think with my mom, it's Asian, for Asian families. I mean, maybe I shouldn't generalize too much, but especially in my family, it's not easy to talk a lot about your feelings and talk a lot about your emotions. I mean, the funny anecdote that I would talk about, I remember, it was when my brother got engaged. He would tell me, and he would say, "Oh, how long do you think mom's gonna talk on the phone after I tell her that I just got engaged, like I just proposed?" And I was like, yeah, maybe the phone conversation will last more than 5 minutes this time. Maybe. And then he goes and tells my mom, and then it's like, nope. I was like, 5 minutes, less than 5 minutes. And then I have a lot of detail to share. Like, kind of gets awkward. The conversation kind of gets awkward after 3 or 4 minutes. And then we kind of have to, like, okay, we'll talk tomorrow now. But, you know, I, everything I've said today, I've said to her. Usually it takes me a few drinks, and it was on her 70th birthday. So, you know, I don't think I have a lot more that I need to say to her. And I think she knows how much, you know, how much she's influenced me. And, you know, and I talk about her all the time, you know. So my mom's actually very introverted, doesn't like meeting new people at all. And then I had this like, you know, dozens of friends who you keep hearing about who all wanted me to. Like, oh my God, your mom's amazing. I want to meet your mom. And I was like, yeah, I don't know if she wants to meet that many new people. Sorry, guys. But yeah, but it's interesting. And for my dad, yeah, I mean, my dad is sort of, you know, a lot of my personality is from my dad. A lot of my brother's personality is from my dad. Like the extrovert side of what I do, I think the ability to connect with people, which my brother also has an amazing ability to. I mean, that all comes from my dad. And, you know, I mean, not to refocus again on my mom, but, you know, one of the things my father used to say is like his greatest achievement in life was he found my mom and married her. And he was always the clever guy, the guy who figures things out, the business guy. You know, I think a lot of the reason for my parents' early success was because of my dad's business acumen. And funnily enough, my dad didn't want to be a doctor. He wanted to be a businessman, but his father said, no, you're going to be a doctor. I'm only going to pay for that. And then my dad's with me. I was like, no, with my brother. No, you're going to be a lawyer. And I have to be a banker. And it's like, and it's just kind of funny that how things repeat. And, you know, hopefully that cycle doesn't continue with my brother and his kids.
What an amazing journey you've had, Jeremy. Thank you so much for sharing it. I've been blessed to meet your mother, and I can't wait to hopefully see her again and give her a big high five or a hug and tell her how much of an amazing job she's done. Jeremy, thank you so much for joining us in the arena. You've been an amazing guest.
Cool. Thanks, guys. I was happy to be here.
Hey listeners, thanks for tuning into this week's episode of the Arena Podcast. As always, you can get notified of the latest release by subscribing to our newsletter found in the description of this episode or by visiting fellows.org. That's all for now. We'll catch you in the arena next week.